From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, way past cool. Jess Mowry used to be a bodyguard for a drug dealer. When he realized that being black and cool was killing gang members, he got involved in another kind of protection altogether. We'll talk to Jess Mowry about teaching kids to move away from the urban warfare. Gail Sheehy got famous in the 70s for her book Passages. Now she's focused on a phase of a woman's life that no one wants to talk about, menopause. Coming up, a talk with writer Gail Sheehy about The Silent Passage. And book critic John Leonard reviews Monday's Warriors by Maurice Shadbolt about Maoris fighting the British imperialists in New Zealand. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush today defended his administration's domestic policy record and insisted that his proposals for revitalizing the nation's cities will work better than the Great Society programs of the past. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The administration came under a barrage of criticism after spokesman Marlon Fitzwater blamed the Los Angeles riots on the failure of the Great Society programs of the 60s to alleviate poverty. Today, as the president prepared to travel to Los Angeles for a first-hand look at the riot-torn area, he said there's no sense in adopting strategies that have failed in the past.
It is far more important to give people a piece of the action than it is to have the federal government simply dump largesse on them. We've tried it the other way. And now this gives us an opportunity, an excellent opportunity, to try some new ideas.
Mr. Bush said it's no time to play the blame game. I'm Richard Gonzalez at the White House.
Last week's riots in Los Angeles temporarily cost as many as 40,000 jobs, and 11,000 of those jobs may never come back. Los Angeles County economist Jack Kaiser said that the temporary job loss of 40,000 will be reduced as big firms get back into operation. Kaiser said the jobs most at risk are at smaller firms that were in older buildings that were destroyed or heavily damaged. Officials estimate that 5,300 buildings were damaged or destroyed during the rioting. Estimates of the costs of arson and vandalism have run as high as $1 billion. Algerian police say three people have been killed in a bomb explosion at the University of Constantine in the east of the country. No details have yet been given about what kind of explosive was used, nor of who might be behind the attack. Jackie Rowland reports.
A homemade bomb was planted on the 14th floor of the university's administrative block. The explosion was followed by a fire which sent students and staff fleeing from the building. The explosion comes after days of trouble in Constantine. On Monday night, there were arson attacks on a number of buildings, including part of the university. As yet, no group has admitted carrying out the attacks. However, the University of Constantine is a well-known Islamic fundamentalist stronghold. The authorities are determined to put an end to the violence, and a number of Islamic extremists have already been sentenced to death. But the sentences might not be carried out, because to do so could lead to a popular outburst of anger. For National Public Radio, this is Jackie Rowland in Tunis.
Stock prices closed higher on Wall Street today, boosted by gains on the London and Tokyo markets. Traders also reacted favorably to the success of today's Treasury bond auction, taking it as a sign that interest rates may go down a bit, sending investors back to the stock market. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 10 points to close at 3,369.4. Advances led declines by a margin of about 10-7 in heavy trading. This is NPR. Lebanon's prime minister resigned today, saying he was stepping down to save the country from unrest caused by the worst economic crisis in its history. Prime Minister Rashid Karami and his entire cabinet stepped down after a three-hour meeting with President Eli Esraoui. The government collapsed as protesters rampaged through the streets on the first day of a four-day nationwide strike called by union leaders. Unions and most politicians blame government overspending and mismanagement for the economic crisis. President Rawi said that he would resort to force to prevent any threat to the relative stability Lebanon has enjoyed since the end of the civil war in 1990. 2 weeks after the devastating explosion in Guadalajara, Mexico, ripples of the disaster continue to affect both government officials and the public. Bibi Kraus reports from Mexico City.
The Mexican government has hired the San Francisco-based engineering firm Bechtel to investigate the state-owned oil monopoly Pemex. Bechtel will identify potential dangers in Pemex facilities and its massive gasoline distribution system. It will also evaluate training of Pemex employees. Four Pemex officials currently face criminal charges stemming from the Guadalajara explosions. And yesterday, the Guadalajara City Council resigned amidst continued public criticism. Another 1,500 people were also evacuated from their homes because of gas leaks. More than 100,000 liters of Pemex gasoline has been found in the city's sewers, and it is feared more explosions are possible. For National Public Radio, this is B.B. Krause in Mexico City.
The London stock market closed at a record high today in response to yesterday's cut in a key interest rate. Analysts said that investors were still generally optimistic about the Conservative Party's victory in last month's national election. The wave of public employee strikes in Germany has also prompted international investors to move into the London market. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowain. Jess Mowry has beaten the odds for a young black man growing up in Oakland. He dropped out of school after the eighth grade. As a teenager, he was a bodyguard for a drug dealer. Later, he was homeless, surviving the streets by picking through dumpsters, looking for aluminum cans to turn in for cash. In 1988, he bought an old typewriter for $8 and began to write. He wrote a series of short stories, including a collection called Rats in the Trees, which won the Penn Oakland Josephine Miles Award in 1990. His second book, called Children of the Night, was about inner-city kids. His latest novel, Way Past Cool, is a grim portrait of gang life in Oakland. Mowry lives in Oakland with his wife, children, and a number of street kids who were homeless. He stays in close contact with the gangs in his neighborhood. I asked him what brings these kids together.
Well, the draw is basically, other than just a normal kid thing, to be together. I mean, any group of kids, you're going to have the tough one, the leader, a certain amount of followers, and you're going to have like a brain, and that's a timeless thing as I see it. But you got another aspect in inner cities is that the kids got to come together for actual protection, because a kid alone is prey to anything. Just like in a book with the one little kid getting his shoes stolen. I mean, that ain't an unusual thing.
Do you think that people wrongly think of all gangs as bad?
Yeah.
Especially gangs in the inner city.
It's just a reaction to what they can't understand. They can't see. Middle-class white people, I suppose, in their neighborhoods and stuff, the kids hanging together there, they may not call themselves gangs, but it's basically the same thing on the level I talk. And I'm talking your major gangs like the Crips and Bloods and stuff like that. But we're talking young kids now on just a basic neighborhood or block level.
In your novel, the leader of the gang is a kid called Gordon, and he's sort of on the chubby side. He's 13 years old. He carries a gun to protect the other guys in the gang and to protect his turf. But he's also afraid of getting in trouble with his teacher for his homework. And you've called some of these gangs little rascals with Uzis. Is that how you see Gordon and the Friends, the name of his gang?
Yeah, these kids be doing the best they can with what they got. I mean, it come down to they may carry guns and they may be able to kill, but that's what society has put on them. I mean, at heart, they still 13, 12, 11, they still be kids. They still open to, I mean, the emotions can change in a flash of an eye blink, and it's just, they just be kids. You can talk to a kid with guns or something, he come in with a gun or something, but he'd be just as worried about getting bawled out by his teacher or whatever, or they ask advice, like, again, they just be kids. Kids in Africa and so forth be in the army at 13, 14. I think reading some of the old English stories, midshipmen on English ships of the line, the sailing ships were like 13, 14 years old. So, they figured they was mature enough then to do that job.
And are these kids mature enough now? What do you see?
I see these kids as... You put them in what, for lack of a better word, say the real world, they be backward. But as far as reading, writing, arithmetic, and that type of stuff, the things that society sets the value on, and actual things that they necessarily going to need to survive in the society. But to survive in the inner city environment, yeah, they'd be very mature. They know all the tricks, and it's just knowledge is passed on. It's like a oral tradition.
What do you see these kids, what do they need to survive? What are some of the skills that allow them to survive in the inner city?
Well, just knowing what to look out for, knowing you hear a car come speeding up the block or something like that, to get out the way or at least look for it because it might be a drive-by, and knowing which people are going to be, nobody knows everything. I mean, there's always a surprise or something, and a lot of these kids come from a single parent. Unfortunately, with the crack situation and the way the economy's going, a lot of these kids be going from a single-parent household to a zero-parent household. I mean, it used to be the stereotype, which unfortunately is true, that the black father wasn't around, and now it's getting the mother's into drugs, or in this case with the kids that I write about, the mothers be out there busting their butts working.
So who do these kids look to, and who do they relate to? Who do they want to model themselves after?
Unfortunately, about the only things we got, which is what I tried to say in the book, is it's cool and bad. I mean, it's a case of the real world don't want you. You're going to be a big fish in a small pond. You're going to live a short life in the ghetto and be on top of your block, on top of your hood or something. That's basically about the only real role models these kids got, the successful dealer, even a bodyguard or pimp or something like that. I mean, money, juice, be the bottom line with this. And that's what society teaches them. I mean, that's what, that's the bottom line in this society anyways, is money, ain't it?
Sure. Well, when I first looked at the title of your book, Way Past Cool, you know, I was thinking cool was cool. But as you write about it, cool is a killer for these kids.
Yeah, cool is a killer for these kids, but they got no alternative. I mean, it go back to a matter of survival. I mean, you can have your, I ain't saying there be the one like, I guess, the traditional label Four Eyes or the book reader or something like that. There's a few that, despite all odds, do go their own way and make it out. And to break from, you know, peer pressure on any, don't matter whether it's an inner city kid or rich white kid or whatever, peer pressure at that age be tremendous, which I guess anybody should know. So,
does black power mean anything to these kids, black pride?
What black pride, what do we got left, especially something after this Rodney King thing? It's like the message was loud and clear from the powers that be to black people that we can do anything we want to do to you. We can do it on national television. We can do it in the eyes of the world, and ain't nobody going to lift a finger to help you. And we'll cry, we're going to defend the judicial system. Well, they be defending the judicial system at the expense of justice. That's all they care about.
What was the reaction in your neighborhood and with the kids that you talked to on the street after the Rodney King verdict? What did they talk to you about?
Well, that night we was more or less babysitting a few, and one of the older ones was that thing, well, let's go out and smoke some white butt or beat up some white people, and one eight-year-old says, yeah, but how are you going to know which ones? Like, he's seen that video about the white truck driver getting hauled out of his truck and stuff, and he first thing he noticed about that was, hey, that dude had his window down, his door unlocked. I mean, he must have felt safe there. Maybe we're married to a black woman or something. I mean, that's the trouble with this racial thing. You don't know. All you see is color.
But what could you say to these kids as they were talking about the verdict, as they were talking about what the verdict meant to their life?
That's the trouble. What do you say? It's clear that there's a war on young black males. There's a war on black youth. I'd take it a step further. There's a war on black males, period, young or old. We get that stress thing with the young because they're easier to pick off. But the system is put that message through loud and clear. We hate you. We're out to get you, and we can do it. So what do you say? You take it. Basically, just come down to one day at a time thing is just keep your head above water and pay the bills and do forth, which you don't look to the future. That's another thing about growing up in that environment. You got no future. That's why the cops, they stop a black dude on the street or something. There'd be like a backup. Half the time they call in a second backup because they'd be afraid of us. They'd be afraid he ain't got nothing to lose. He can do anything, and that's the way these kids grow up. We got nothing to lose anyway. We're going to die. We might as well die doing something bad, something cool.
In your novel, there's a scene where, in fact, it's early on in the book, where this gang, the Friends, is stopped by a group of cops. And Gordon, the leader, says, cops got a way of turning everybody into nothing. How do they do that?
Well, just if you'd read it, well, obviously you did. It's an attitude thing. Myself has gone through that. I'm about 13 and was stopped for questioning by two big cops, twice my size, probably three times my weight, and they didn't like to give them smart-ass answers, of course, being bad and cool. They didn't like the answers. They took me around the corner and beat the, I don't know if I can say it on the radio, beat the hell out of me. That's better than what I was going to say. But you grow up with that. You see that. Then you go to this school thing where, you know, the cop be your friend and stuff. What they tell you, come down to, they ain't practicing what they preach. And a cop's job can't be easy. I can never do it. I admit that. But and on that level, I sympathize with them. But they by and large, or at least my eyes and the eyes that the kids are seeing out of, is that we're just dirt, we're just garbage, we're just nothing. I could say the N-word, but I think you get my point. And we don't count for nothing, never going nowhere. So die young and save us the trouble. Kill your own selves and save us the trouble. That's the way these kids see the cops.
So the cops are the enemy?
Yeah, the cops be the enemy. And the cops, again, since they be out there, they be the visible, authority figures. They be the, well, they be the policemen of the system. I mean, the police people, the system, whatever. They the ones that enforce. They the ones that are out there telling you do this, do that, don't do this, pushing you around and so forth. So, of course, they be the visible targets.
You mentioned that when you were young, getting stopped by the police. Does that still happen to you? If you're in a neighborhood outside of your own neighborhood in Oakland?
Well, I walk into this building here this morning, and early in the morning, and the receptionist looked at me like I got the impression she'd about jump out of her skin. I said I was here to do a recording or something like that, and give some names and stuff, and she still wasn't sure. And then I said, well, can I use your bathroom? And she hesitated, and finally, she's probably just doing her job, but I think if I'd have been in a business suit and stuff like that, which I ain't, and I get treated different. I mean, you grow up your whole life, Dad, and it happened every day. It's like they never let you forget. It's everything's begin to sound like a stereotype and a cliche, but it's that way because it's true. They never let you forget. White people never let you forget that you're black. I ain't saying there ain't a lot of good white people out there. The majority might be, but on the levels that me and my kids and the people I know operate on it, you see damn few of them.
And is that what you look for when you are in conversation with a white person or you're passing a white person? Are you looking for that glance, that small movement that's going to give away, what, their fears, their prejudices?
Well, mostly you get so you don't pay attention to that no more. I mean, unless there be a reason to or something, or unless it... Sometimes it's amusing to do that, to watch, you know, the women clutch their purses and windows roll up on when you walk by on the sidewalk or something like that. But you spend a lifetime doing that. After a while, unless it's affecting you directly, it's just something, unfortunately, you've accepted. I think it come down to, it was told to me once by somebody, is white people don't spend no time thinking about being white. And when you're black in this society, at least from what I've seen, you got to spend a lot of time thinking about being black.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jess Mowry, and he's just written a novel called Way Past Cool. It's about two rival gangs in Oakland who are fighting over a piece of turf. And we're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air.
My guest is writer Jess Mowry. Let me ask you, because since the riots in Los Angeles, you hear social historians and policymakers talking about some kind of urban policy, something to do about the problems of the inner city. Is that a good conversation to have? Does that mean anything to you and to the kids that you know?
Well, there's a song which I don't necessarily agree with, a new song, fairly new out by a group called Naughty by Nature, and they say toward the end that if you don't never been to the ghetto, don't never come to the ghetto because you wouldn't understand the ghetto. And I ain't saying I agree with that mentality, but it come down to a point where just exactly what's to be done. The trouble is with, as I see it, with Black Power that you mentioned back, we can't get together. We can't. There's something, whether we're bickering among ourselves or whether we're supposed to bicker among ourselves or whatever, the people that should be coming together to do something, and it's going to have to be on a Black level, just for some reason ain't been able to do it. Now, maybe this incident and maybe the rioting and the protests and stuff will help some, but the problem with the inner cities is basic stuff. No jobs, second, third, fourth, fifth generation welfare, which is no jobs, no hope, no future, no role models. I mean, you just take one to people a hell of a lot smarter than me can't figure out. I mean, I just wrote a book. You know?
Yeah, right. But are you talking about a Black solution to...
Well, it's going to have to start with us, and we're going to have to come around this thing about we best stop killing each other, and because that's exactly what they want. It's exactly the game they be playing. It's just like the crack be custom tailored for us and our kids and the whole drug thing. I mean, if they wanted to stop the powers that be or something, wanted to stop, they could stop it coming into this country on the high levels through the shiploads and airplanes. Seemed to me a lot easier to stop one ship than after it spread out all through the city or something like that. They won't do it because there's too much money being made on that level. It ain't little Black hands bringing that stuff into this country.
I'm speaking with Jess Mowry, and he's a novelist. His latest book is called Way Past Cool, and it's about two rival Oakland gangs, the gangs called The Friends and The Crew, and... they're fighting over a piece of turf in Oakland. Actually, they call Oakland Oaktown. And we're talking about his neighborhood, the kids that he knows in Oakland, and also talking about the events in Los Angeles and what that means for kids in the inner city. You mentioned the fame and the fortune that's changed your life. I assume this has come from the books and the advances that you've gotten and also movie people that are interested in the books as well. That is what is going to take you out of your neighborhood, you think? Does that make you a target, for instance?
Yeah, to a certain extent, to a certain element, it does. I mean, why would a person, you know, with a steady income or with some decent money live in a place like this? So they got money, so meaning us, and money be like a disease in reverse. Everybody want to catch it. I mean, people asking for loans and stuff like that. And we help. We've already given a lot of the money away to different things and help families move out. We help one family move up to Portland, for instance. But I got to thank my own family, my own people too.
Well, what do you think you can do on the outside if so much of what you've been doing is just living in your neighborhood and being with these kids and talking with them and being a man to them? What can you do if you're not there?
Well, basically, it's what you say way back when we first started talking is, do you like to do interviews? I say, well, no, I don't. One of the reasons I don't is I feel that whatever I got to say be in my book. I mean, the kid's going to have to learn to read to make it. Going to have to, if a kid can read and the book's been selling here, and that mean more to me than anything, it's been selling here in Oaktown, just out a little local all-Black bookstore that ain't even on the book system, computers and stuff like that. And people be commenting about it, and when I was parking my car this morning before I come here, a man be working on his car, he said, oh, I seen you on TV last night. Right on, you be saying that. That what mean to me, but go back to your question is, what I got to say is probably best said in my book. I was able to edit it until I got it to where I was happy with it, which I can't do. I can't do when talking. I don't talk that good.
Do you feel hopeless? Hopeless about the situation in your neighborhood now and the kids you know and the problems of the deep, deep problems of the inner city?
Well, I felt hopeless all my life, but it's not, once you accept the fact that this is the way things are, I mean, it's kind of, you turn it into a joke thing. It's just like walking down the street or something, see a trail of blood down the street from last night. Well, somebody got popped, you know, or whatever like that. It's just, you keep your sense of humor, gallows humor, you want to call it that. There ain't never no hope, it's been said by other people. It's just, you keep trying, you can get out of here if you want to get out of here, but it's hard. You got to set your sights on that. You can't get sidetracked. You got to want to do something.
You were part of a gang. I guess this would be back in the 70s, is that right?
Yeah.
How different was that gang from the gangs that you know now?
Well, there wasn't as much firepower out on the streets, and of course, there wasn't crack then, but there was other things and stuff. I say basic. I say it would basically probably be the same with a little less gunfire in the background.
And you were actually a bodyguard for a while for a drug dealer?
Yeah, and it's funny. He turned out to be pretty good. I heard he's back East City doing something with kids and some kind of social program or something. It just goes to show you that, you know, there ain't never no hope. I mean, you give somebody a chance, give somebody opportunity, and let them grow up and let them see all sides of a question or something. And I ain't saying they all do it, but maybe somebody decided, yeah, I don't want to hurt my brothers and sisters no more. I want to do something. But if he hadn't grown up, I mean, I probably saved his butt a couple of times. And if I hadn't been there to, you know, you can get into that religious thing about, well, you was meant to do this or meant not. I don't necessarily believe that. But the point is that if 90% of these kids had a chance to grow up and make some mistakes, even though some mistakes may be hard and cold, that they might turn out to benefit society in general.
How did you get out of the drug trade, your route out of the problems or the life that you had as a teenager?
I just got to that point where I'd be saying this, I hurt my brothers and sisters, and this ain't right. I think everybody's basically good. I think everybody inside knows what's right. I think you watch a bunch of small kids playing, you see that in a hurry. So I just decided that this, not one thing, but not one big flash, but it was decided that's it. If I'm going to be here, let them laugh at me, let me be uncool, but I'm going to try to help instead of hurt.
Jess Mowry, thank you so much for joining us today on the show. I really do appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Jess Mowry is a writer and lives in Oakland. His latest book is called Way Past Cool. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowane with Fresh Air.
this edition of Fresh Air, menopause. In a culture obsessed with youth, it's a phase of a woman's life that no one wants to talk about, but all women go through. Coming up, a talk with Gail Sheehy about the silent passage, her examination of what she calls America's last taboo. And book critic John Leonard reviews Monday's Warriors by Maurice Shadbolt. It's about Maoris fighting the British imperialists in New Zealand. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The president of the newly independent Ukraine has reassured officials of the Bush administration that his country will give up its nuclear weapons. NPR's Ann Garrels reports.
President Kravchuk told President Bush Ukraine will join the non-proliferation treaty as a non-nuclear state, and the two leaders agreed on a protocol to the START treaty, under which Ukraine's weapons would count against overall cuts in long-range nuclear weapons. Signed last year, the treaty was thrown into question when the Soviet Union collapsed. The long-range missiles to be cut are on the territory of Russia and three other now-independent states. With Ukraine now on board, attention is quickly shifted to Belarus and especially Kazakhstan. The president there has been particularly ambiguous about the fate of his nuclear arsenal. President Nazarbayev now says he wants security guarantees from the United States, Russia, and China before giving up his weapons. Secretary of State Baker is to travel to Kazakhstan soon, concerned the START treaty could unravel if these issues remain unresolved for long. I'm Ann Garrels in Washington.
President Bush is now on his way to Los Angeles on a trip scheduled before last week's rioting there, but now instead of centering on trade, will include visits to damaged areas of the city. Before leaving Washington, Mr. Bush said the country can improve on great society programs of the 1960s and 1970s in dealing with problems of the cities. Mr. Bush said about half of the 1,000 federal law enforcement officials sent to Los Angeles last week have been pulled out, and he said that military troops still on duty there won't be much longer. In Bosnia, heavy fighting has resumed in various areas of the country, despite yesterday's ceasefire. Pierre Vickery reports that a top U.N. diplomat came under sniper fire as he toured the capital, inspecting damage caused by days of heavy fire.
Merrick Goulding said he was extremely shocked by the scale of suffering the bombardment of Sarajevo had caused the city's civilian population. Although the heavy Serbian guns were silent today, dozens of mortars still rained down on the capital, and the UN envoy had to take shelter when his group came under sniper fire in the Muslim old town. After meeting representatives of the Bosnian leadership and the Yugoslav Army Command, Merrick Goulding said it was extremely unlikely the United Nations would agree to send a peacekeeping force to Bosnia, since the necessary agreement between the warring factions was clearly missing. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 10 points to close at 3,369.41 on volume of some 199 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 10-7. This is NPR News. Former Soviet President Gorbachev says that the nations of the world should work together on common problems, including crime, drug abuse, and hunger. Speaking this afternoon at Fulton, Missouri, the former Soviet leader called for a bigger role for the UN and more members in the UN Security Council. He said if Germany and Japan were part of the UN Security Council, this would end a post-World War II stance of victor and vanquished. It was back in 1946 that Winston Churchill spoke in Fulton and said an iron curtain had dropped across Europe. In London today, Britain's Queen Elizabeth II opened a new session of Parliament and outlined John Major's government program for the coming months. NPR's John Itzty reports from London.
The Queen travels to Westminster in a horse-drawn coach. And from a throne in the House of Lords, she delivers a speech prepared for her by the Prime Minister and his cabinet. Near the top of the agenda for this re-elected Conservative government is the denationalization of two government-run industries.
My government will pursue vigorously their program of privatization. Legislation will be introduced to return British coal to the private sector.
John Major's government also intends to privatize parts of British Rail. An opposition Labour Party spokesman called the plan a return to the tired agenda of Thatcherism. On foreign policy matters, the speech pledged full support for NATO and promised efforts to strengthen the UN, enlarge the European community, and complete the single market. I'm John Itzde in London.
Unocal Corporation says it will do away with at least 400 jobs in its efforts to slim down operations. The company also plans to sell or enter into joint ventures on at least $350 million in assets. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. It happens to every woman, yet few want to discuss it. My guest, Gail Sheehy, wants to end that silence, so she's written a book about what she calls the last taboo, menopause. Sheehy is best known for her popular psychology book, Passages, which propose that there is a common set of stages in people's lives. Sheehy is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair magazine, where she's been writing in-depth psychological portraits of politicians and world leaders. Those articles led to her books, Character, America's Search for Leadership, and The Man Who Changed the World, The Lives of Mikhail Gorbachev. Sheehy calls her new book on menopause, The Silent Passage.
No one talks about it. It's amazing. The most profound and possibly even longest passage in a woman's life that every woman goes through, whether it's store clerks or movie actresses. And yet, no one talks about it, not even women talking among themselves.
Can you describe for us, and I'm quoting here from your book, the night I was hit by the first bombshell of the battle with menopause?
Well, it was the most peculiar thing, because I had just recently been remarried. I was happy as a clam. I had an adopted daughter. I had another daughter already launched well. I was delighting in being able to be free enough to run around the world as a political journalist. There I was sitting in this cozy cocoon with my new marriage and my husband snuggled up around newspapers, Sunday night, snow at the window, and suddenly this sort of static began in my brain. And I said, what was that? Couldn't figure it out. I laid down, and even while I was lying down, my heart began pounding very hard. Later, I found that this is one of the common symptoms of estrogen deprivation. And from there, it went on to crashes of fatigue. At the end of the day, I'd come home, I'd say, well, I'll just take a little nap, and then I wouldn't want to get up to make dinner or have it. And then there were kind of waves of the blues. Every once in a while, I'd find myself just crying for no reason. I'd read a page, and it would kind of wash out in front of me, that sort of... You know, at 40, you can't read the numbers in the telephone book. Well, at 50, all of a sudden, you can't remember them. And these are very very upsetting, very vague. Then I began to worry about bone loss because I remembered my own mother suffering so badly from osteoporosis that she couldn't even enjoy sitting in a chair and reading in her late 60s. So I went to a doctor and I said, gee, I'm only 48 and my cycle is still normal. Could I be in menopause? And he said, no, you're too young.
Hmm.
Well, he was dead wrong. Most women begin to have symptoms like one or more of these in their mid-40s. And the most difficult phase of the whole menopausal passage are those first year or two that are given a name that I'd never even heard of, called perimenopause.
The symptoms that you describe seem to come at you one after the other. You describe a little grenade going off in your head. For the other women that you interviewed, how common was it to have menopause hit so hard and fast?
Well, there's nothing common about menopause. It's more idiosyncratic even than puberty. And you remember, in puberty, well, I mean, some of us were wearing undershirts when we were 13, and others of us, were embarrassed because, they looked like full-grown women. So it's similar here. But the first symptom or sign is often a change in your cycle. I mean, it either gets longer or shorter, heavier or lighter, closer together or farther apart. Now, what's common about that? Except that erratic is what is normal. And the other sign is the hot flash. And the first time you have a hot flash, it may be in a public situation, like a woman I write about and who was at a very fancy dinner party. And all of a sudden, she began perspiring. It was dropping down on her nice white satin collar. Her husband was shooting her looks of panic. All she wanted to do was to get up, run into the kitchen, open the freezer door, tear off her clothes, and just stand there and get cool.
What choices did you think that you had then to at least begin to deal with some of the symptoms and side effects of what you were experiencing?
Well, I had no idea what the choices were, and my first gynecologist didn't give me any because he refused to acknowledge that I was in menopause. I was in perimenopause, as I told you. He sort of thought you have to qualify by being a year free of any cycle, which is, by that time, you're in postmenopause. So I went finally to a wonderful female gynecologist, Pat Allen, who helped me with finding the best researchers and clinicians on the cutting edge of this subject. And I found that you have to audition for the right physician. In other words, you have to ask your doctor, how many women do you have who are over 45? That tells you if they have many menopausal women in their practice. And how would you define menopause? And can you have symptoms in your mid-40s? If they tell you you're too young and you can't have symptoms, then you know you've got the wrong person. You just say thank you very much and find another person because you must be a supervisor of this process and you must believe in your own signs and symptoms that they have, that they're real.
Well, how do you go about weighing some of the risks and benefits of hormone replacement therapy? Being that, yes, it's your body, of course, that's experiencing this, but you're not a medical doctor, so it's hard to get up to speed so quickly on what you think would be the best course of action.
Well, that's what I try to do in the book, is to lay out the options and to tell you how to take your own family history, what really counts. For instance, there's such a panic about breast cancer now, and we've just recently learned that the figures have been exaggerated to some degree. What matters is if your mother or your sister had breast cancer before they reached menopause. Other than that, there isn't a great deal of impact genetically on you. You need to know what's the history of heart disease in your family, because the most likely reason that you will die after the age of 50 is not breast cancer or cancer of any kind. You're 10 times more likely to die of heart disease. And what protects you mostly from heart disease? Estrogen. Then you have to find out about your bones. Did your mother or your grandmother have problems with thinning bones? Did they ever get a fracture? Did they have trouble bending or walking or sitting in their 60s? Did they get confined to home or to a wheelchair because they had problems with their bones in their 70s? It's a terrible crippler. And again, estrogen replacement therapy or hormone replacement therapy is it can maintain the bone that you have. And if you take it regularly in addition to exercise and calcium supplements, it can rebuild some of the bone that you've already lost. So those are the pluses.
I want to talk some more, but first I want to take a short break. My guest is Gail Sheehy, and she's just written a brand new book. It's called Silent Passage, and it's about menopause. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Gail Sheehy is my guest, and her book is called Silent Passage, and it's about menopause. Do you think there's a danger of medicalizing a natural life process, which menopause is? It's what happens to women as they get older. And do you think by medicalizing it, everyone runs to their doctor and feels ill and feels that something is wrong?
Well, I do think there's some danger in medicalizing it. Many women experience only a few signs of the hot flashes, the most common, and they may have very temporary other difficulties. So I spend a lot of time in the book talking about how to partner yourself through a natural menopause and some of the very useful holistic remedies. Vitamin E is helpful with hot flashes, for instance. There's a wonderful Chinese herb easily available at health food stores called Dong Quai, which suppresses hot flashes. Ginseng, Siberian ginseng, is helpful for fatigue and some of the depressive symptoms. Some women find acupuncture very helpful to control symptoms in hot flashes. And then as far as protecting your bones, the most important natural thing to do is to keep the acid level in your blood down. And that means no more carbonated sodas or red meat, because they're both very high in phosphorus content. And also try to cut down on coffee and certainly cut out smoking. And find some relaxation that you can do regularly, whether it's yoga or meditation or biofeedback, so that you keep the acid level down in your bone and it doesn't then leach those important minerals that keep your bones strong.
Well, because menopause is not a disease, do you think that researchers have been late to study the whole phenomenon of menopause and left women like yourself with very little to go on?
Well, it's not a disease, but it does set up a hormonal milieu in the body that does make you prone to difficulties and to, as I say, heart disease and osteoporosis. And that is inexcusable that those elements of a woman's health history have not been studied and explored to a fare thee well. We know all kinds of things about heart disease in men and how to protect them. We don't even know how to protect women from heart disease because the symptoms of it are more subtle and different. And one of the shocking statistics is that women who do contract heart disease die more often with the first heart attack because they're not given the risk-saving techniques that men are. And does this affect a lot of people, menopause? I mean, the figures are staggering. Of the American women who are either approaching menopause in that perimenopause phase I mentioned, in it or past it, the total number is 43 million women.
Having looked at this whole issue of menopause, your own, and interviewing other women that are going through menopause, what do you see as the important research that should be done?
I think the most important thing is to bring all women into the research. Practically no studies have included anything other than upper-middle-class white women because they are the people who live near the university centers that have done the small studies. The class differences in the experience of menopause are really glaring. Most lower-income women just assume it's another burden of being a woman, and they just grin and bear it. Here we go again, male doctors treating me like I don't matter a damn. And they don't know the questions to ask. They don't know how to treat themselves. And the difficulty that means that their families may go through, and the broken marriages and the disruption between children and mother is unforgivable. So that's the first step. Then the other, women of color have never been included in the studies. So that I found out in researching the Silent Passage that black women are far less likely to have psychological symptoms or bone loss, but what they do suffer from much more than white women is fibroids, which often lead to unnecessary hysterectomies. Now, there are necessary hysterectomies and there are unnecessary ones, but do you know that 1/3 of American women reach menopause surgically through hysterectomy? Now, there's something wrong with that figure. And we don't even have a counting mechanism for how many women, state by state, and region by region, are being told to get this very serious surgical procedure, often because they just go in and say, I'd like to have my tubes tied.
When I was asked what I was going to be talking with you about today, and I said, I'm going to be talking to Gail Sheehy about menopause, everybody made a face. Why do you think people have such a difficult time with it beyond the kind of cultural taboo? But do you think for many women it has to do with losing one's femininity, which is so tied in with the ability to have a baby, that somehow you begin to think of yourself as a different kind of person and maybe not even a woman person?
Well, you know, that's a terrible misnomer. You don't lose your femininity because you no longer can use the magic of reproduction. I mean, men don't lose their masculinity when they no longer father children. The fact of the matter is that you have as many years left, if you reach the age of 50, in your post-reproductive life as you have had in your reproductive life. And the advantages of post-reproductive life allow you to take the full measure of your masculine and feminine aspects of your nature, to become one of the wise women of the culture. You no longer have some of the problems that you have when you are fertile, such as pregnancy fears, such as blue meanie moods every month, such as the daily responsibility of getting from A to B to C when you're trying to balance many aspects and be a mother. So that you're free to take your place as part of the culture, its wisdom, to pursue your passion, whatever it is that you didn't have time for when you were a young woman, just trying to make all the balancing act work.
Is this what Margaret Mead meant when she said, when she talked about postmenopausal zest?
Yes, it did. And as a matter of fact, Margaret Mead's story is in the book. And her daughter, the anthropologist Catherine Bateson, made her records available to me. And it was quite wonderful. Margaret Mead went into 50. She got herself estrogen. She got a new wardrobe. She took on a new lover. She relearned languages of the South Pacific and went off on a field trip to explore a whole new direction and write a new book. It was one of the most exciting periods of her life.
Gail Sheehy, thank you so much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
My pleasure.
Gail Sheehy's book is called The Silent Passage. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about All Things Considered today. What stories from Los Angeles, Noah?
Hi, Marty. Robert Siegel reports from there about the disgust that many in the black community feel toward the legal system, especially after the killing of a young black woman by a Korean grocer. Andy Bowers looks back on last week's trouble and the role of the media over those 3 days. Wendy Kaufman on new charges that the Los Angeles police failed to act quickly enough. President Bush is talking about the problems of Los Angeles, saying the people should be given a part of the action in rebuilding. And sociologist Harry Edwards in California agrees, in part, saying that efforts should be made to bring the communities together.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The two main islands that make up New Zealand are inhabited by 3.5 million people. About 12% of the population is Maori, the indigenous culture of that land. For several decades in the mid-1800s, Maoris fought European settlers to keep control of their islands. There's a new historical novel about that time by Maurice Shadbolt, one of New Zealand's foremost writers. Critic John Leonard has a review of Monday's Warriors.
Suspicious as I am of historical novels, I am equally ignorant of New Zealand. So an historical novel about the 19th century wars of British imperialism against Maori tribes, who would really rather stay put on their ancestral lands, with their flax baskets and calabash gourds, their greenstone clubs and their lizard carvings, their tame pigs and their wild honey and their God-given hunting and fishing rights, well, I was a tough customer. But Maurice Shadbolt, however angry he may be at what resembles a dress rehearsal for genocides to come, is also an exceedingly witty writer. In Kimball Bent, an actual figure in New Zealand history, an American Yankee who couldn't get out of the British Army except by deserting, he has created the perfect disaffected character. Ironic, sarcastic, looking out for number one, inadvertently heroic, and equally likable to the Maoris and the reader. Part Jack Crabb in Thomas Berger's Little Big Man, and part Fabrizio in Stendhal's The Charterhouse of Parma. It was Kimball Bent's good fortune, at about the time of our own Civil War, to meet Te Toko, a one-eyed Maori chief and former Methodist, in a bowler hat and waistcoat, with a silver-capped cane and parrot feathers. Tetoko, also an actual figure in New Zealand history, decided he'd had enough of treaties torn up, villages burned down, and sheep grazing on his sacred volcano. What happened next was a brilliant guerrilla campaign of the sort the West would later see in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Thus, says Shadbolt, was a penny dreadful turned into a shilling shocker. When imperial regiments raised their churches, these former Methodists, we are told, salvaged such of the scriptures as served sudden death, pledged allegiance to angry angels sailing the four winds, roused the tribes to an occult chant, souvenired the heads of soldiers they slew, smoked them to traditional recipes, and marched such prizes into native regions seen in need of a new faith. Kimball Bent marches with them. He makes their bullets and cannonballs, and he's not bad with a bayonet. In his company, we will meet not only a raffish crew of warriors and their randy women, but lots of creepers, bats, moss, rainbows, and latrines. We will also meet Tara Pikau, the demon who collects female parts, in whose river eels are red. And we will sit down over an open fire to eat, besides potted pigeons, the hearts of our enemies. There were, says Shadbolt, correct cuts and incorrect cuts. Human meat was best left to make its own sauce, with a light seasoning of convolvulus. Best of all, we will visit the mind of Tetoko, who tells the British, "You were made white men, and the land of England was given to you for your tribe. I was made Maori, and New Zealand was the land given mine. Why have you not taken thought? You forget that there was a great gulf fixed between us, the ocean. You, ignoring that, leaped from your place to mine. I did not leap from my place to yours." He also wonders what his warriors should do with the British Empire. "Do," asks Bent. "When we govern it," explains Tetoko, "perhaps we should sell." If, after reading this novel, you don't root for the doomed Maoris, you deserve the 20th century.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. Fresh Air's senior producer today is Fred Landrell. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Thad Kirk, and Audrey Vablaitis. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed today's show. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional grants are provided by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, filmmaker Marcel Ofels. He's best known for his 1970 documentary, The Sorrow and the Pity. His latest film is called November Days, and it's about life behind the Iron Curtain and the changes underway in Europe since the fall of the Berlin Wall. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.
And hear Gorbachev's speech in its entirety tonight at 10:05 right here on 91 FM. So please join us. The overnight forecast, mostly clear and cold, scattered frost, the low.